In confusion and uncertainty, there emerges a guiding light, a beacon that cuts through the darkness. Welcome to Beacon of Truth with your host, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beacon of Truth. I am your host, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, and you're listening on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Great to be here with you today as we begin this new month of July. And again, this is for us in the Northern Hemisphere. This is the midst of our summer season. You know, hopefully that you're getting to spend more time with family and friends and doing a lot of wonderful summer activities, but not forgetting about your faith. You know, we don't take a summer vacation from our relationship with Jesus. You know, so hopefully we're doing fun things with the family, but also faith-filled things with the family as well. So I've been thinking about each and every one of you and praying for you that you have a very safe and wonderful and enjoyable summer. And for those of you in the land down under, right, in Australia and those in the Southern Hemisphere, I know that this is your winter time and also a very big catechetical time for all of you. So I'm praying for each and every one of you as well. That the God continues to bless the great work that you're doing for all of Christ's faithful. And, of course, being witnesses to all those who don't know Jesus. There's still, you know, many, many people throughout the world who don't know who Jesus is, who don't know his love. And so we need to continue to be witnesses to the power of God's love to every single person that in our lives, whether, you know, in our sphere of influence or just someone that, you know, looks like they may need prayer. You know, I was talking with someone the other day that, like me, they're not a spontaneous prayer. You know, they're not, they don't see someone and says, you know, how can I pray for you today? I mean, there's plenty of people who do that, and that's fine, and that's awesome. But typically that's not me, you know, but I shared with you an experience I had with a cleaning person in a Delta lounge in Atlanta. And someone shared with me a very similar experience, how it was in Eucharistic adoration that God had pointed out someone that was in the adoration chapel with them. And God told this person in their heart to pray, to go over to that person and to pray. So they thought, well, no, I'll just sit here and pray for them. You know, but God said, no, I need you to get up and go over there and ask that person if they need prayer. You know, and so the person was reluctant to do it, didn't want to do it. So finally, you know, God, you know, just told them that I need you to go over there. So they went over there. And as it turns out, the person was going through something very difficult and was incredibly grateful for the person who came over to them and asked for prayer. And so that's, you know, and so that was she said that was the first time. And then there's been several more times now where God has asked her to do the same thing. That person needs prayer. Go over there and ask them how you can pray for them. And so, and now she says it's just, you know, as soon as she feels that tug, hears that internal voice of God speaking to her, she just responds, you know, and that's how God works. You know, I remember a long time ago when I was in adoration in 2011, when God first put on my heart to leave my law enforcement career to speak full time, I was like, no, I don't want to do this, you know, and God directed my gaze to a crucifix in that adoration chapel and said, if you want to take your relationship with me to the next level, you have to get uncomfortable, you know. And so sometimes, you know, God shakes things up in our lives, gets us a little bit uncomfortable to, you know, participate in a very small way in his sacrifice on the cross, because on that cross he was very, I mean, to say the least, I mean, it's a complete understatement to say that he was uncomfortable. You know, that one of the most excruciating ways to die back in the time of the Romans was crucifixion, the most horrific, painful, and embarrassing death that the Romans could imagine. Jesus endured that. And so, but think about it. Jesus sometimes asks us to get out of our comfort zone, to make ourselves uncomfortable, that in a way that doesn't cause any pain, where it's not painful to go over to someone and ask them for prayer. It's not painful to hand a few bucks to a homeless person on the street. That's not painful, you know. So why sometimes are we reluctant? Because that's not, sometimes it's not in our personality, right? It's not, we don't see ourselves doing something like that. But sometimes God shakes things up in our lives. He needs us to be uncomfortable so that his people can be served. Because remember, God is still bringing the message of salvation, the message of hope, the message of his love and his peace and his mercy through us. We are the vehicles of evangelization. We are the witnesses to the power of his love. And God says, I need you to be the one to get this message across to this person over here. And often, because why? Because we happen to be the person that literally physically closest to that person. You know, maybe God just thinks that we have the right temperament, that this person will be open to accepting prayers from us specifically. You know, so we always have to be ready, always have to be prepared. And most importantly, our hearts have to be open to hear God's voice when he speaks to us in that way. And, you know, just to, when God asks us to do something uncomfortable for his glory, that's going to benefit the well-being of others to help bring them closer to the love of Christ, we have to respond and say yes. You know, just be prepared. So that's why we always have to, I believe, live a Eucharistic faith in the world, right? To challenge ourselves to live out those greatest commandments that Jesus teaches us, to love God and to love our neighbor as ourself. And sometimes that means serving our neighbor, asking for them for prayers. You know, look, it happens to me on the plane. You know, I'm the guy that, you know, when I sit down, I can't put on the headphones fast enough so I don't have to talk to anybody. You know, I'm not a conversationalist, because people say, well, you speak for a living. You know, you're a professional Catholic speaker. Yes, that's true. But I was also a monk, you know, so I love silence and quiet. And so, but sometimes when somebody, you know, I'm not going to be rude, but somebody starts to talk to you on a plane, you know, I'm going to have that conversation. But honestly, I try to end it as quickly as possible, you know, so I can have my alone time. But you know, sometimes, you know, the flight attendant or somebody will see me praying a rosary or praying the office, on the plane, and ask me for prayer, you know, and I have to be ready to respond and say yes. And even to say, you know, what can I pray for? Or I just, you know, just, yep. I'll say a quick prayer for you or something like that. But, you know, not be afraid to make ourselves a little bit vulnerable before the Lord. No, so I'm excited today because we're continuing our series called Jesus and 12 and the 12 on tour. You know, we do these series of shows where we talk about Jesus in certain particular areas of the Middle East and in Israel and the Holy Land where he ministered to his people. And today our tour stop takes us to Jericho, that wonderful city in the desert. Not too far from Jerusalem. But that's our topic today, Jesus and the 12 on tour. Today's stop, Jericho. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email today, beacon@ewtn.com. And I also love the people who help make this tour possible, which is this show every day. I'm talking about Matt Gabinski, who screens your calls, Michael McCall, and Pedro Quiles, who help us out on social media. And of course, the man himself, Ace McKay, our producer. How you doing, Ace?
I'm good. Just rolling up cables. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, we don't want to take for granted how important those roadies are.
Oh, I know, right? It's like, and how many stories have we heard probably in the last 4 or 5 years of roadies or guitar techs or drum techs who have joined the band when someone exits, or they filled in a hole, like learn the songs, like do the things you're supposed to do. But, you know, you never know when you might actually be asked to be in the band or on stage. That's kind of the perk of the job.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you can make a connection with our spiritual life too. Mm. Like I said, we always need to be prepared to respond.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why we have to be continuing. We have to be people of prayer. We have to be live out a sacramental life. We always have to keep our minds and our hearts focused on putting God as the center of our life. As we always say, we're just instruments, God's a musician, and the more we become finely tuned instruments in God's hands, the more God can use us. Just like that roadie, he has to step in and take that role, us, and sometimes God does that for us spiritually. We got to be able to be ready and willing to step in there, and get our hands dirty in the vineyard.
Yeah, amen.
All right. Jesus and the 12 on tour, continuing our series of looking at the different places where Jesus lived, worked, and ministered to his people. Today's tour stop, Jericho. And we'd love to hear from you today. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com.
Love a good halftime.
Yep. Yeah.
As a drummer, it leaves room for all kinds of things, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And again, this is one of the, that it's a slow groove, but it's like the attitude, like.
Yeah. 100.
Yeah, nice feel that.
Yeah, those actions.
Oh, nice. Nice. I like that. Yeah, a little time signature change there. Wow, that's cool.
You know, as we talk about Jesus on tour, you know, he's got his disciples and his followers around. Do you think they sang or did they had musicians that went with them that kind of accompanied maybe any additional, like, worship along the way? I just feel like that they would... At some point, you run out of things to talk about, so you break out into song, maybe?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, because remember, they walked everywhere
back then.
So they were a pedestrian society for the most part. The only ones that traveled on horses and things like that were soldiers or people that were wealthier. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure, just like in the car, after sometimes you drive alone, you're alone with your thoughts, but then sometimes you got to turn on the radio you and the kids start singing and stuff like that. And I'm sure this was the case with Jesus. They would be walking for a while, talking, maybe talking about the things of the Lord, and just break out a psalm.
Yeah.
Remember, they sung. The psalms were sung. The Sefer Telachim, the Book of Sung Praises. So I'm sure somebody broke out with a psalm and they were just singing and praising the Lord as they walked along.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wouldn't surprise me at all. In fact, I know for a fact, now you say that, Ace, I know for a fact that when they went to Jerusalem for one of the three feasts, the Feast of Passover, Pesach, the Feast of Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks, or the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths, which was the wheat harvest and the fruit harvest, that they would sing the songs of ascents or gradual psalms.
Okay.
Psalms 120 to 134. They would sing those as they were heading toward Jerusalem. So it wouldn't surprise me that they would sing maybe not those psalms, but other psalms or even just whatever, songs they had back in those days.
Sure.
Singing those as they walked along. And I'm sure Jesus sang too.
Well, yeah, that was going to be my next question. I wonder what kind of singing voice he actually had. Like, what was the timbre? What was, the range? Just all the things.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I don't watch television, so I haven't watched The Chosen very much. I've seen a few episodes because sometimes I stay in rectories with priests. And so I, for a little fraternity, I sit with them for a while, and a lot of priests end up watching The Chosen, So I've seen a few episodes of that, and you see Jesus laughing and Jesus, I mean, things that you typically don't see in the scripts that kind of fill in the blanks on that show. But I'm sure that he sang. I remember one episode I saw with a priest. He had crashed a wedding reception, and Jesus got in there and started dancing,
I love that.
They had like a not a line dance, but like a circle dance, something like that. He jumped in a circle and was, dancing with them, and the bride and the groom. He gave them a blessing and everything. I think from what I've seen of The Chosen, it shows very much the human side of Jesus, so which I think is, from what I saw, I thought they did it in a very respectful way, but it showed the humanness that Jesus, was just like us in all things but sin, and participating in a wedding reception where he's, doing the traditional dances with the people. That's nothing. That's not sinful. There's nothing wrong with that, and he had fun, I'm sure, with his apostles as well,
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he's doing the cha-cha slide or something, weird like you see at a wedding today, but yeah, I mean, that's the part that I think we oftentimes can miss about Christ is that when he was here, he enjoyed the human experience just like we did, so that he could set the example. He could also embrace all the things to better understand what we were all going through, highs and lows.
And another that's a way he connected with people as well. Entering into the culture and all the experiences of the culture. The Jewish culture in a good way, the customs, the ceremonies, and of course dancing at a wedding, a feast which lasted for days actually, would be something that I'm sure he did. The wedding feast of Cana, I'm sure that he probably danced there as well. Just sharing the joy of the bride and the groom. And he continues to do that with us today. He shares in the joy that we have, whether it's a wedding or whether it's something, a birth of a child or something else going on, ordination or something going on in our life, that he is there. And even I think when we're singing, when we're praising the Lord in that way, that he's also there with us as well.
Well, and I love the tradition, and I don't know how many people know this, but like the newlywed phase for married couple, like that came from the fact that they used to take 2 years, just the two of them. Like they would just go off and get to know one another and really bond in their relationship. And so that's where that term comes from. I mean, how amazing would marriages be today if you could just spend the first 2 years doing nothing but spending time with each other?
And that doesn't surprise me, because in some of those cultures back then, the marriages were arranged, so you kind of didn't have a choice about who you married, but that wouldn't surprise me, getting that time to get to actually know each other, which is actually backwards, obviously, from what we do today. And I'm a believer in taking time to get to know someone well, because I mean, what you don't want to do is rush into something. Yes, there have been situations and talking with people who have, love at first sight kind of thing. Like they met the person they just knew, and they got married just after like 6 months or something like that, and they've been married for, decades. Every once in a while it does work out that way, but most of the time you really need to get to know, especially today, when so many people are on social media, so many people put up false personas. They're trying to portray an image, and you really gotta dig through all that to really get to the real person, to get to know that person in their heart, and are they a person, a true person of faith, or are they just going through the motions to impress you? I mean, so yeah, it takes time to discern all that, especially in all the technology that we're dealing with today. And I'm sure, like I said, obviously, I'm not doing any dating or anything like that, obviously. But I'm sure on these dating apps now, with AI as prevalent as it is, some people may be putting up fake profiles, fake images of themselves to make themselves look, or maybe use it as, sadly, as a platform to maybe fool people, and maybe even some stalking. Because we can, so you gotta be really careful when it comes to doing stuff like that online now.
Well, and this summer was, the summer for my daughter to get married, and I talked to her like a week after, because they're saving their honeymoon to go in the fall because they want to go to Disney, so they don't want to do it in the scorching hot summer. Don't blame her. But I asked her, I said, hey, how's the first week of marriage? Does it feel married? She goes, I've realized how much stress I was under getting ready for the wedding that I cannot imagine the amount of pressure that Thomas, who's now my son-in-law, that he was seeing of me through that. So now I feel like he's getting more of a relaxed me, more of a genuine, I was like, well, but there's going to be seasons that you are going to be stressed, that you are going to be, you know, on edge about things, whether it's work-related or life-related. I said, so it's good that he knew how to help navigate those things with you, because that's what your marriage is. Like, you never stop learning. I always say to, like, new couples, when you're first dating, go through four seasons together. Because then when you get back to that fifth season, you can apply the things that you learned, so that then every season is another opportunity to say, hey, okay, I feel like I really understand you when, you know, your falls are really busy or your summer is really chilled and we get more time together, whatever it may be. But it's through the seasons that we learn the most and then love each other unconditionally.
Yeah, I remember that was true for Colleen and I as well. I remember planning the wedding. I had a big notebook. Again, this was back in the days where laptops and computers were very expensive.
Yeah.
Back in the early 90s. And so I had a big notebook and I had, like, tabbed out all the different things, you know, like, I mean, she was planning too, but I mean, I kept everything in one place, everything organized. I mean, that's just, ever since I was a kid, that's just what I did, organize.
Sure.
In fact, I developed that because after my dad was out of the picture, and my mom, you know, I kind of took on the role of helping my mom. I said, well, I have to, if I'm going to do this, I have to be organized. And so, and plus I was a Boy Scout, so I was a good student. So I learned, you know, even though it was a difficult time, I'm grateful for that, because I learned a lot about organization and things, which has done nothing but benefited me to this day. But I remember after all of the planning, all the, and the wedding was over, and we went to Kauai. And who went to the Big Island and to Kauai, went to Kauai first, precisely because there's almost nothing to do there on Kauai.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to relax. And it was just so relaxing. And just now it's just the two of us. And it was a great, great experience.
Yeah, that's so cool.
I love that. All right. I'm Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, listening to Beacon of Truth. And today we're continuing our series, Jesus and the 12 on Tour. We're looking at all the places where Jesus lived, worked, and ministered. And today's tour stop is Jericho. And we'd love for you to be with us today. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com.
Of course, maybe you're watching us on YouTube today. Make sure you click that subscribe button, because then not only do you know about live shows, but you can find all kinds of great content on both TV, radio, and otherwise. But make sure while you're on YouTube today, subscribe. That way you can keep up with what's happening with EWTN Radio.
Yeah, that's right. I'm subscribed. So
those notifications go off all the time, right?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love that. So, whenever I go to my YouTube channel, you know, because I go there. Well, I actually go there almost every day, because I always check. Because sometimes, like, I link talks that I've given, instead of, like, I don't upload them. I just link them from the person who has the talk on. You know, so I do for, like, this show. I don't upload the show. I just link them. To EWTN's page on my website.
Yeah.
And sometimes those links are broken, or sometimes they take down a video. You know, so I go through and just check to make sure that all the links are working, all the videos are there. But subscribing, you can see, oh, there's a new video there, you know.
Yeah.
I don't, like, get messages on my phone or anything like that. But whenever I'm there, I see, oh, there's new content there. And I always click on it to see what's the new and latest from members of the EWTN Radio family.
Yeah, I always have to laugh when my wife and I go to bed at night, because her phone will start buzzing because her friends and stuff are, like, commenting on things that she's done. And I'm like, you're very popular. Why do they wait until now to make your phone buzz all night?
Yeah, that's it. Love that. Jesus and the 12 on Tour. Taking a look at the places where Jesus lived, worked, and ministered in the Holy Land. And today's tour stop is Jericho. Would love to hear from you. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com. All right, kind of Devo kind of feel there a little bit. Yeah.
Put some upside down pots on our heads.
Yeah. That's cool.
It's that era, right? That 81 to 84, like it's just...
Yeah, that keyboard sound is definitely from that era for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always wonder how, like when especially comes to keyboard sounds and keyboard patches, you know, how did it come up with a particular sound that defines an era?
Right.
You know, like when you hear this, you know, oh, that's the 80s. You like, you know, you think of a band, you think of an era. You know, I guess if a song became popular, then a lot of other bands would use a similar kind of patch or a similar kind of keyboard sound.
Yeah.
Would that, do you think that's it? And that would kind of define that particular era of music?
Well, as a former disc jockey, my perspective is this, that number one, you had certain groups who were doing music videos that were not necessarily American. So when MTV started and they were still in that rock and roll before they started playing artists like Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston, and you know, it was very much a rock and roll channel. They were just looking for what was up and coming. And so like the new wave sound, what we now call new wave, was all coming from British groups and, you know, other countries that were just experimenting. Hey, what is it? What happens if I plug this pedal into my keyboard that I normally use on my guitar? And they're finding stuff, and then you know, the creation of the drum pad and whatnot. So there's that, right? So that then influenced everything. But then you couple it with just the idea of that, what's the next sound? Like when you came out of disco, what was going to be the break to then go, what's the next thing? And so I think a lot of artists are always like, well, this is what I was into, or, you know, we used to do this in, you know, my college radio station. We played around with samples and, you know, create our own music. So I think it's that, like just the freedom to just create. And there's, when there's no rules, then eventually it becomes the mainstream, and then people burn out on that, and it defines that era. So like, if you really want to look at like a music history, I always tell people, look at it in 5-year increments. So look at the first 5 years of a decade, what was going on, then look at what happens as it transitioned into the back five, and then how it almost comes back around full circle. Like a lot of times early in a decade, you have singer-songwriter stuff, and then latter you have more big like anthems or dance, you know, if dance is the thing or if rock is the thing or metal's the thing, it's that shifts. So like early 60s, early 70s, early 80s, very much a singer-songwriter kind of vibe as they were all experimenting with whatever instruments and sounds were attractive to them.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, Gary Numan. You know,
sure.
A lot of great keyboard stuff on there. Of course, we talked about Kraftwerk before, which is basically nothing but keyboards. And even,
right.
You know, 1984 Van Halen, 1984 incorporating Jump, incorporating yeah. keyboards. You never really heard a ton of keyboards in Van Halen stuff until that era there.
Yep.
You know, and then you had a more of an evolution, like you said, from the rock, like Michael Jackson's up with the synth bass.
Yep.
Like a Smooth Criminal, something like that, you know, bump, bump, ba-da-dum, bump, ba-da-dum. Again, mm-hmm. using the keyboards and those patches in different, of course, with rap, the 808, the big, heavy, big boom, you know, and so, yeah, so just using, I would agree with your assessment there, you know, looking at different genres of music, how they incorporate the keyboards, and even prog rock,
yeah,
you know, yes, you know, Dream Theater, early Genesis using keyboards, you know, and synthesizers, you know, as a really an important part of that sound from the band during those times, and even to this day, you know, Dream Theater still uses as Jordan Rudess, who's incredible, Juilliard kind of, you know, keyboardist, you know, just incredible. So it still defines the sound even today.
Yeah, so true. I love that.
Yeah, all right. I'm Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, listening to Beacon of Truth. And today we're continuing our series called Jesus and the 12 on Tour, where we take a look at the places where Jesus lived, worked, and ministered to his people in the Holy Land. And today's chore stop, Jericho. Of course, we'd love to hear from you today. Send us an email, beacon@ew10.com.
As we get closer to the weekend, we get closer to the wisdoms of Father Groeschel every Saturday morning, 1 Eastern on EWTN radios. We pull from his wisdoms, all the archives, still very applicable in 2026. But if you want even more of those, Father Benedict has CDs, DVDs, books, all of that in the religious catalog. Just go to EWTNRC.com today.
All right, Jesus and the 12 on tour, taking a look at the importance of Jericho in the work, in Jesus's work and ministry in the Holy Land in Israel. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com. So Jericho, which I've been to, again, I'm so grateful to God for the opportunities I've had to speak and to travel all over the world, to 34 countries so far. And I've been to the Holy Land about, I think, 4 times I've been there. So I'm grateful, incredibly grateful. And again, let us all pray for the efforts of peace everywhere in the world, right, including Russia and Ukraine and Taiwan, all these other places that are hot spots right now. But of course, the Holy Land as well, so we can get back over there and see and experience these incredible places. As we talk about these tour stops, you can actually see and experience them for yourselves. Let's continue to pray for peace. But Jericho is about 15 miles northeast of Jerusalem in the area called the Jordan Valley. Beautiful, beautiful area there. It's known in like Deuteronomy chapter 34, is known as the City of Palms. And there's still palm trees there, actually, to this day. It's kind of like an oasis in the desert kind of a place. And it was a symbol of fertility and wealth, but also a city where the walls fell. Right. So remember in Joshua chapter 2, the place where they crossed over the Jordan into the Promised Land. Remember that Joshua, who was the son of Nun, who took over for Moses. So Joshua is in charge now, and he sends spies to reconnoiter the land of Jericho, to go in and see how strong the armies were, how the city was fortified, would they put up much of a fight against the Israelites when they came in to take over the land that the Lord had promised to them. And so they sent spies over there. And the spies came back and said that, there was a wall, and some of the spies were trying to incite the people and say that we shouldn't go over there, that, that they're going to kill us and all this kind of stuff. Joshua encouraged the people to have faith in God. So God comes to Joshua and says, that famous scene where for 7 days they walked once around the city for 6 days. And on the seventh day, as they walked around the city 7 times, and the seventh time they walked around the city of Jericho, they blew horns. And as they blew the horns and shouted the cry, the walls of Jericho fell, and they went in and, took over Jericho without without much resistance. So that's where we see kind of Jericho early in the scriptures there. So by the time of Christ, Jericho was a pretty prosperous center for trade and commerce. And it was a crossroads for pilgrims en route to Jerusalem for one of the feasts, right? So this would have been, a city that they stopped in, to rest, to get supplies, to take a breather, to enjoy themselves maybe for a couple of days before finishing the journey to Jerusalem. Because I talked about this before, one of the three feasts, the feast of Passover, or the unleavened bread, the Pesach, or the feast of Pentecost, also called the feast of weeks, which was the wheat harvest, the Shavuot, which happened during the summer. And the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths, which was the fruit harvest called the Sukkot, which would happen in the fall. And so they would, again, go to Jerusalem on one of these three feasts. And Some of them would stop at Jericho. So Jericho appears prominently in the Gospels as a place of both spiritual healings that Jesus did and also spiritual conversion. So physical healing and spiritual conversion. As Jesus was approaching, as he was going to his final journey to Jerusalem. So for example, in Luke chapter 18, we see that as Jesus drew near to Jericho, a blind man was sitting on the roadside begging, right? So Jesus healing the blind man. In Mark's gospel, remember the man sitting at the side of the road was named Bartimaeus. So in Mark's account, in Mark chapter 10, he's the one who cried out, "Jesus, Son of David, have pity on me." And so that's a beautiful story. So why you should go back and read that, either Luke chapter 18 or Mark chapter 10, where Jesus is heading to Jerusalem. He's going through Jericho. Bartimaeus is sitting at the side of the road. He hears, obviously he can't see, he hears the commotion. What's going on? They're telling him that Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. And he cries out, "Jesus, Son of David, have pity on me." And the other people try to silence him. "No, just be quiet, you old beggar. Nobody wants to hear from you. That's the Lord." And he cries out even louder. And why? Because he has faith. And in fact, he has faith, even though he can't see, that if he cries out to the Lord in his need, right, that the Lord will come to him, right? In fact, that's almost word for word from a psalm. They cried out to the Lord in their need, and he rescued them from their distress. Maybe Bartimaeus had that psalm in mind when he cried out to the Lord, and despite the embarrassment that he was maybe even bringing to himself because he was crying out so loudly, but what happened? The Lord heard him and stopped. The Lord heard him and stopped, and asked Bartimaeus to be brought to him. And so I can imagine that beautiful scene, his friends picking him up. "Have courage, the Lord has called you." So he goes over to Jesus. Maybe he can't see, so he's feeling his way over there, and they put him in front of Jesus. I'm sure he's probably touching Jesus, maybe even touching his face with his hands, and just so he can, okay, this is the guy, this is him. I'm actually in front of the Lord, like he can't, like almost can't believe that he's actually finally has this opportunity. And what does the Lord say to him? Something very strange. "What can I do for you?" Let's see, Lord, you're God. You know everything. You know very well what he's doing there. He's blind. I mean, what do you think he wants? I mean, it almost doesn't make sense for him to ask, what can I do for you? But why does he ask that question? He gives Bartimaeus the dignity of asking for help. He just doesn't assume, oh, you're here just like everybody else because you want something. No, he gives him the dignity of asking him for help, not just assuming. He allows Bartimaeus to ask, "Master, I want to see. I want to see. And I know," I'm adding this part, right? "I know that you are the one that can make that happen. I have faith that you are the Christ. You are the Messiah. You are the anointed one of God. I believe that with all my heart. And so I come before you, Lord. Even though I had to embarrass myself to get here, I had to yell, but you heard my voice. You heard my cry. And so now I'm asking this of you, Lord, to bring healing into my life." And what does the Lord say? Jesus restores his sight, saying, "Your faith has saved you. Your faith has saved you." Beautiful, beautiful words from our Lord. And so the other thing that we see in Jericho is the conversion of Zacchaeus. Again, in Luke 19, this is a chapter later in Luke. So the healing of Bartimaeus was Luke 18. Now we're in Luke chapter 19. Jesus entered Jericho. Again, as he was passing through, of course, on his way to Jerusalem, there was a man named Zacchaeus. Now, Zacchaeus was short in stature, and he had to climb a sycamore tree in order to see Jesus. Now, I can relate to that. I can relate to Zacchaeus because I myself am not very tall. In fact, almost every single person who meets me for the first time, I thought you were taller. I thought you were, I mean, literally, it's the first thing they say. I thought you were taller. So somehow I must look taller on EWTN television. I don't know. So I can relate to Zacchaeus. So he had to climb a sycamore tree. Now, if you go to Jericho, the tree, the actual tree, is no longer there. But they do have a tree from around that time of Jesus that's still there. So obviously, they can't say for sure that that was the tree Zacchaeus climbed up, but they do have a tree that you can see from the bus that was around that time of Jesus. So you get kind of, at least you can see the type of tree that Zacchaeus would have climbed. So Jesus is passing by under the tree. He called Zacchaeus by name. Hurry down, because I'm going to stay at your house tonight. And oh my goodness, Zacchaeus was so excited. He was so excited that he got to host the Lord. So of course, Zacchaeus had a reputation, for shortchanging people. And I think he might have been a tax collector. Tax collectors were of ill repute back in that time. And so he, you know, so with Jesus in his house, he comes to conversion. I will give back, more than what I took, and I'll restore everything that I've taken, and what does Jesus say? Today, salvation has come to this house, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost, right? And Zacchaeus was lost, but after his encounter with Jesus, he was found again, and so two very, very powerful stories there of our Lord. And so let's take a look. Let's go a little deeper here. So, what are some of the themes? What are some of things we can draw from Jesus' tour stop here in Jericho? First of all, Bartimaeus was physically blind, but he still sees that Jesus is the Son of David, that he is the one chosen by God, that he is the anointed one, the long awaited for Messiah. So even though he was blind physically, his heart was open spiritually to see who Jesus was. While many others were still trying to figure out who Jesus was, Bartimaeus was able to see him, right? Quote unquote, see him. And so his persistence, even while being silenced by the people around him, that shows that discipleship, our following Jesus, is rooted in faith. Not following Jesus because we want to be like everybody else. And I say this even for couples that are engaged, where one of the people is not Catholic, and they say, well, I'm thinking about becoming Catholic. Don't do it because of him or her. Don't do it because your fiance is Catholic. Oh, I just want to make her or him happy. So I'm just going to be, no, you should do it because you truly believe that God is calling you to the fullness of faith. That's why you should do it. When I did marriage prep in the parish, I would say, and it kind of surprised them. You don't want me to become, you don't want me to become Catholic? No, it's not that I don't want you to become Catholic. I want you to do it for the right reasons. Because think about it, say this thing doesn't work out. What are you going to do? Are you going to stop being Catholic now because it didn't work out with her? So you have to really discern, am I doing this to make her happy? Or in the case of a woman, to make him happy, or is God truly calling me to this? So if things don't work out between us, that I've still and made the decision apart from my fiance to become Catholic. That's what you need to discern. And if you're not there yet, at least you're honest about it. At least go to the OCIA class, and again, not to become Catholic, but at least to learn what the Catholic Church teaches. When you're in this relationship, you can see, okay, here's what the expectations are. Here's how my fiance is going to live once we're married. This is the teachings of the faith that I'm going to make a promise to keep and uphold, even though I am not Catholic at this point in my life, right? So we have to see with the eyes of Bartimaeus, right? So I think that's a huge lesson for us there. And then, of course, with Zacchaeus, you know, as he was a not yeah, in fact, he was not just a tax collector; he was a chief tax collector. Now, remember, tax collectors were seen as because they would take extra taxes. Well, first of all, they were collecting taxes for Rome, so they were already seen as you're taking money from us and giving it to our enemies. And then they would be corrupt as to take extra and keep the difference for themselves. You know, and so he was despised as a collaborator with the Roman enemies and as a sinner. Yet, again, he sees Jesus, right? Not like Bartimaeus, he sees Jesus with his eyes. Actually, he can't see Jesus, which is why he has to climb a tree so he can just get a glimpse of Jesus. And Jesus, seeing the effort that he made just to see him, he says, come down, I'm going to have dinner at your house. Now, I'm sure when Jesus said he's going to have dinner at his house, kind of invited himself, you know, but he was still very excited. I'm sure some people said, wait a minute, of all the people Jesus could eat with, he's going to eat with this guy? This corrupt tax collector who steals from us to give to our enemies? Again, that's why some people said, well, why is he eating with tax collectors and sinners? And Jesus said he came to be with those who needed saving. He, like he said with Bart, he said to Zacchaeus, you know, he came to show the path to the lost, to get them back on the path to salvation, who were on the road to destruction, or who didn't even know there was a road. Hey, hello. Sometimes they didn't know there was a road, and Jesus shows them the path to mercy. Through his mercy, shows them the path to salvation. Right. And of course, finally, this is Jericho was the last major stop before Jesus going to Jerusalem, you know, to suffer to institute the priesthood and the holy sacrifice of the mass at the Last Supper and to fulfill his whole reason for coming into existence, to die on that cross, to open the way to salvation. By conquering death, he opened the doors to life for each and every one of us. And so Jesus prefigures healing and conversion that would come through following him, that would come through the work of the apostles, that would come through even down to us today. So the healing of Bartimaeus and the conversion of Zacchaeus are prefigurements of the salvific acts of love and mercy that God will give us through his passion, death, and resurrection, right? The blind, those who can't see Jesus, receive their sight. Sinners are forgiven. Salvation enters into our homes, into our lives, into our hearts, right? And so the early church fathers witnessed this. You know, Origen said that Jericho was a symbol of the fallen world, into Christ descended from the heavens and entered into our human experience in order to raise us up to where he is with his Father in heaven. And Jesus says, you know, my Father has many houses in his mansion. I go to prepare a place for you. You know, Saint Augustine saw Bartimaeus as an archetype of the human race, blinded by sin, crying out for mercy, and being healed by Christ. All right, so Bartimaeus represents all of us who are blind to the ways of the Lord. And so God still gives us that work today, that we, as followers, as disciples of Jesus, have to help open the eyes of others who are blind to his love. You know, very beautiful insights here. In Gaudium et Spes, the Second Vatican Council document, Joy and Hope, kind of looking at the church in the modern world, it says that the Zacchaeus encounter reflects the church's mission to uphold the dignity of all, even the most despised, by offering the path to reconciliation and salvation. You know, this is why we have to evangelize. This is why we have to share the beauty and truth of our faith. Again, not beating people over the head with the Bible, not proselytization, not forcing people to follow the faith, but to show them by our lived witness and example the face and the hands and the heart of Jesus. So Jesus' journey to Jericho, though brief in the narratives, is deep with theological significance of conversion and healing. And so Jericho prefigures the cross and opens the way to salvation for each and every one of us. All right, tomorrow we're going to continue our tour stops, Jesus and 12 on tour. Tomorrow's tour stop, Bethphage. Now remember, you can stream today's show by visiting Podcast Central at ewtn.com/radio. And until we're together again, my friends, may Almighty God bless you, keep you, and protect you. The Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.